السلام عليك أيها البدر الطالب.
Peace be upon you, O shining light. Peace be upon you, O rising full moon. Peace be upon you, O pure one from among the pure ones. Peace be upon you, O immaculate from among the immaculate ones. Peace be upon you, O pleased and pure. Peace be upon you, O Abba Ja'far, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious, the faithful leader, and Allah's mercy and blessings be upon you.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sador Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه و جورسپروденس
is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
Self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hojjatul Islam Mandegari. Stay tuned. Whoever trusts in Allah only and administers the affairs based on His teachings will reach salvation both in this world and the hereafter. Allah is the only one that has been successful in all the affairs given to Him. This is why Allah refers the people in the Quran to the examples that had trust on Him to learn from their stories. The Godvary are those who made the covenant with Allah, and the unbelievers are those who had trust in entities other than Allah. Therefore, we must believe in Allah as the sole administrator of the affairs. We must also act upon His plans in our life so that we become God-wary. This means that in all aspects of our life, we only consider Allah and we only trust in His plans for our life. This strategy includes all dimensions of our life, from trivial points to the biggest ones. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hojjatul Islam Mandegari. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Years of war in Syria has destabilized the region, which is still suffering from an ongoing humanitarian emergency. Millions are displaced within Syria or have fled to Turkey, which is contending with high inflation and a deepening economic crisis. The earthquake unleashed widespread damage and destruction in some of the most at-risk areas in the region. A magnitude 7.8 earthquake struck near Nurdaghi in southern Turkey around 4:17 a.m. local time on February 6th. A magnitude 7.5 earthquake followed around later that afternoon around 1 p.m. local time, along with the scores of powerful aftershocks. Thousands are injured and thousands more remain trapped in the rubble, and the chance of finding survivors gets narrower and narrower. Search and recovery operations continue with assistance from teams around the world. But freezing weather is hampering rescue efforts and making it even more difficult to access possible survivors. This catastrophe hit an already fragile region, which has been marked by decades of war in Syria and economic, humanitarian, and public health crises. Turkey is facing a profound economic crisis, with a collapsing currency and extraordinary inflation that hit around 80% last year, the highest in about 25 years. The quake-hit part of Turkey also hosts a large population of Syrian refugees. The economic crisis in Turkey has helped fuel a backlash against the approximately 3.6 million Syrian refugees in the country, who are already facing poverty, discrimination, an increase in violent attacks, and the risk of deportation. More than 2 million people in northwestern Syria are also at risk of a deadly cholera outbreak. The outbreak began in northeastern Syria, attributed to contaminated water from the Euphrates River, which people were relying on in part because of the water infrastructure destroyed by years of fighting. About 47% of people in Syria rely on unsafe drinking water, a potentially even bigger risk after the massive infrastructure damage by the earthquake. In northwest Syria, in particular, this outbreak was straining an already stretched and under-resourced health system, which will now also need to find ways to treat those injured in the earthquake. The devastation extends beyond northwest Syria, as the country as a whole has been overwhelmed by years of war and destruction. International sanctions against Syria are also deepening the economic crisis Syrians face. The country faces record and widespread poverty and food shortages. About 90% of Syrians live below the poverty line, and nearly 75% struggle to meet their most basic needs. And across the region, the crisis is still acute, as agencies and officials rush to find survivors in the rubbles and temperatures drop. The earthquake compounds catastrophe upon catastrophe in Syria and Turkey. It is likely to exacerbate those that already exist while creating new, unpredictable ones. The United Nations Secretary General says Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has agreed to open two more border crossings to facilitate relief aid delivery to the northern part of the quake-hit country, which is held by militants. Antonio Guterres announced the development after Assad approved the use of Bab al-Salam and al-Ra'i crossings, which link Turkey to northwestern Syria for outreach purposes. In line with the presidential decree, the crossings would be open for an initial period of 3 months to allow for the timely delivery of humanitarian aid. In addition to authorizing transit through the border passages, the UN chief said facilitating humanitarian access, accelerating visa approvals, and easing travel between hubs will allow more aid to go in faster. The announcement was made after the UN Security Council held a closed-door session on the humanitarian situation in Syria following the quake. The 7.8 magnitude quake that hit Turkey and neighboring Syria last Monday has so far claimed tens of thousands of lives. The biggest part of the fatalities that have been caused in Syria have occurred in the territory which is being held by Takfiri terrorist groups. The approval issued by Assad came after the UN lamented that an anti-government group, which has been designated as terrorist by the international community, was preventing aid consignments from being delivered to the quake-hit areas in the northern part of Syria. A spokesman for the UN's humanitarian aid office said on Sunday that there were issues with approval by the group, which was identified as a terrorist outfit, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS. Previously, a number of captured Takfiri terrorists had confessed to close cooperation to U.S. military forces in Syria. There have also been reports of U.S. supporting Takfiri terrorists and helping them to expand across Syria. Also on Sunday, Reuters quoted an HTS source who spoke on the condition of anonymity as confirming that the terror outfit will not let in shipments from government-held parts of Syria, alleging, "We won't allow the government to take advantage of the situation to show they are helping."
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi is set to pay an official visit to China at the invitation of his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping. The visit will deepen the China-Iran relations, as the two Asian countries have in the past showed their strong determination to boost strategic bilateral cooperation in various fields. A Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman has confirmed that the Iranian president will pay a state visit from February 14 to February 16. Raisi will be heading a high-ranking delegation, including Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian, Minister of Finance and Economic Affairs Ehsan Khandouzi, Oil Minister Javad Oji, and Governor of Iran's Central Bank Mohammad Reza Farzin. The members of the delegation would hold talks with their Chinese counterparts and sign cooperation documents in the presence of Raisi and Xi. Meeting with Iranian and Chinese business leaders and Iranian expatriates are also part of the president's itinerary. Late last year, Chinese ambassador to Tehran Chang Hao described China and Iran as old friends and new partners, expressing his country's eagerness to enhance all-out relations with the Islamic Republic. He said that China regards the relations with Iran from a strategic viewpoint and will not back off from their resolve to promote a comprehensive and a strategic partnership with Iran, which he called a new chapter in their relations. Raisi's visit is expected to also focus on the U.S.-led Western domination of international affairs, as Beijing and Tehran have a common approach on the issue. The Iranian president's visit to China comes at a time when the world is going through numerous challenges. Nevertheless, Beijing and Tehran have many issues of common concern, such as Afghanistan, regional stability and development, climate change, energy security, and others, which the two sides are likely to put on their agenda of discussions. Relations between Tehran and Beijing go as far back as the ancient Silk Road. The ties are gaining a new momentum due to the West's attempt not only to marginalize Iran under U.S. pressure, but limit China's cooperation with Iran and thwart its economic and political influence in the Persian Gulf region. It seems the Western measures have rather pushed Tehran and Beijing into a new alliance. This can be seen in a lot of repeatedly escalated tensions between the United States and Iran over the past four decades. The U.S. has not only prevented its own firms from trading with Iran since the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, but with anti-Iran sanctions also pressured its European allies to follow the same. And that helped Chinese companies move in and fill the void. Over the years, Iran and China have forged a unique partnership that is not easily viable with any other country. China is still Iran's biggest oil client, despite Washington's bid to bring the country's crude exports to a halt. Their railway had become a magnet for engineering and rolling stock firms from all around the world before U.S. sanctions in 2018 forced them to withdraw. The pullout left the Chinese with a less contested business terrain. For China, its close involvement in building Iran's manufacturing infrastructure is seen entirely in line with its mammoth One Belt, One Road initiative. Under the same milieu, the two countries signed a landmark 25-year comprehensive strategic partnership agreement in March 2021, defining the unilateral U.S. sanctions on Iran. The deal officially documents the Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership announced during a visit by the Chinese president to Tehran in 2016. It sets the outlines of cooperation covering major fields ranging from oil and mining to industry, transportation, and agriculture. Both countries have had tense relations with the United States and have sought to project themselves alongside Russia as a counterweight to American power play. The U.S. animosity has also played a key role in bringing Moscow and Beijing together. At this moment, what seems to be of a high urgency for Iran, China, and Russia is to create a united front that could not only serve their national interests, but help bring international peace and stability and protect those countries that are fed with the U.S.-led Western pressure and bullying.
The Russia-Ukraine war is about to enter its first anniversary within days. So far, thousands of people have been killed and many more displaced. Now, after nearly 1 year, the war has turned into a bigger conflict, an encounter, rather, between the West and Russia. Many countries, including the U.S., Germany, France, and the U.K., have been fanning the flames of the conflict by sending military aids worth billions of dollars. In the U.S., there has been a long debate among politicians on whether to support Kiev in its war with Russia. Some back the U.S. support for Ukraine. Others, however, take a different stance. Among them is Congressman Matt Gaetz. The Republican lawmaker has introduced a bill which calls for an immediate end to U.S. military and financial support for Ukraine. The resolution also urges the warring sides to negotiate a ceasefire.
How much more for Ukraine? Is there any limit? Which billionth dollar really kicks in the door? Which red line we set will we not later cross?
Throughout the war, Gaetz has been critical of U.S. support for Ukraine and has previously called for an end to the policy.
I will not vote for one more dollar to Ukraine. I will not vote for one more piece of materiel to Ukraine. We are far too entangled in this conflict. I believe we have extended this conflict. And I call on the Secretary of Defense to declassify the Inspector General report on the compliance with our existing regulations regarding chain of custody with materiel going to another country.
Gaetz has also taken a jab at President Joe Biden. In a statement on his resolution, Gaetz said President Joe Biden must have forgotten his prediction from March 2022, suggesting that arming Ukraine with military equipment will escalate the conflict to World War III. He added America is in a state of managed decline, and it will exacerbate if we continue to hemorrhage taxpayer dollars toward a foreign war. We must suspend all foreign aid for the war in Ukraine and demand that all combatants in this conflict reach a peace agreement immediately. Gaetz's resolution has so far received 10 co-sponsors, including Andy Biggs from Arizona, Lauren Boebert from Colorado, Marjorie Taylor Greene from Georgia, Anna Paulina Luna from Florida, Thomas Massey from Kentucky, and Mary Miller from Illinois. The bill introduced by Gaetz notes that the U.S. has already authorized over $110 billion to spend on the war in less than a year. The resolution comes after a series of escalations of U.S. military aid, including M1 Abrams tanks. It also comes at a time when Ukraine is seeking fighter jets from the U.S. and its allies. Each escalation risks a direct clash between Russia and NATO, which could quickly spiral into a nuclear war. But where does this rising U.S. opposition to continue aid to Ukraine come from? If U.S. taxpayers knew that half the income tax dollars that they sent to the Internal Revenue Service every year was being spent on weapons, war, and war preparation, political support for such programs might significantly decline. As a matter of fact, no agency of the federal government communicates to taxpayers how Congress spends their money. Purchasing weapons and military services with taxpayer dollars has always been and continues to be a highly profitable endeavor for defense contractors. But it is in a real war, like as in Ukraine, that such profiteering truly thrives. President Joe Biden's budget proposal to Congress for 2023 included $813 billion for the Pentagon and military expenditures. This is more than half the income taxes citizens send to the federal government each year, and a more than $31 billion increase over the already bloated fiscal year 2022 Pentagon budget. It is also more than the defense budgets of the eight next biggest military spenders put together, including Russia, China, and India. One of the components of the $782 billion Pentagon budget is for the purchase of new nuclear-armed submarines, even though the U.S. already has 14 lethal Ohio-class submarines, each capable of launching 192 nuclear warheads. Canceling two of these unnecessary and provocative new weapon systems would save more than $10 billion. All in all, what seems to be a non-negotiable is the U.S. taxpayers' money, which could and can be allocated to other needs. What seems to be clear, not only to American taxpayers, but to the whole world, is that the U.S. military-industrial complex is the only one who benefits most from such aid.
Back in September 2022, a number of blasts occurred in the Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2 natural gas pipelines. Following the attacks, there were gas leaks around the pipelines, which were built to transport natural gas from Russia to Germany through the Baltic Sea. Both pipelines are majority-owned by the Russian majority state-owned gas company Gazprom. Back then, there was much speculation about who may have been behind the sabotage act, but now a leading U.S. journalist has blamed the blasts on the Washington regime. In a detailed report published in his blog, investigative journalist Seymour Hersh has claimed that the bombing of the Nord Stream underwater gas pipelines in the Baltic Sea was ordered by the White House and carried out by the CIA with the help of the U.S. Navy. Hersh says the finding is based on his own investigation into the September sabotage. He says U.S. Navy deep-sea divers planted the high-powered C-4 explosives under the gas pipelines under the guise of NATO naval exercises. The bombs were detonated on September 26th. With a remote signal sent by a sonar buoy, which was dropped near the Nord Stream pipelines by a Norwegian Navy P-8 surveillance plane. The planning process began back in December 2021, when a special task force was created with the direct participation of U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. The White House dismissed the report, but Russian officials say the published facts should become the basis for an international investigation. Russian Foreign Ministry says the United States has questions to answer over its alleged role in explosions. Earlier this month, Germany's public prosecutor general, Peter Frank, said that Berlin has no evidence linking Russia to the sabotage of the Nord Stream 1 and 2 gas pipelines. According to Hersh, the Biden administration was focused on Nord Stream pipelines because as long as European countries like Germany remained dependent on those pipelines for cheap natural gas, they would be reluctant to give military aid to Ukraine for a war with Russia, which was looming back then. The U.S. was a major opponent of the Nord Stream pipelines. In 2019, the former U.S. President Donald Trump said that Nord Stream 2 turned Europe into a hostage of Russia and placed sanctions on any company assisting Russia to complete the pipeline. In December 2020, then-President-elect Joe Biden expressed his opposition to the opening of the new pipeline.
If Russia invades, that means tanks or troops crossing the border of Ukraine again, then There will be no longer a Nord Stream 2. We will bring an end to it.
How will you do that exactly, since the project and control of the project is within Germany's control?
We will, I promise you, we'll be able to do it.
Swedish and Danish investigators have already found that the ruptures were a result of sabotage, but they have not specified who was responsible. The attacks occurred in exclusive economic zones of the two European countries. The 1,200-kilometer pipelines, operated by Russian gas giant Gazprom, are not currently in operation. Since the blast occurred, Moscow has blamed the West for the damage to the infrastructure. According to reports, the decision to undermine the Nord Stream 1 and 2 was agreed upon and approved personally by the U.S. President Joe Biden, that he discussed the issue with his inner circle for more than 9 months.
Senator Cruz, like you, I am, and I think the administration is very gratified to know that Nord Stream 2 is now, as you like to say, a hunk of metal at the bottom of the sea.
The Russian government described the sabotage as a terrorist attack and said that the U.S. was the nation that benefited most from it by speeding up Europe's attempts to wean itself off Russian gas.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosro Shahi,
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, Tuhide kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, an introduction into the thoughts and works of the most outstanding prominent Shiite scholars and thinkers all across the world. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio, I have two very special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Shaykh Rouhani. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the main outstanding Shiite fuqaha of the 8th century Hijra. He is mainly known as Shaykh al-Shahid or Shahid al-Awwal, Muhammad ibn Jamaluddin Makki al-Amali, the author of Al-Lummat al-Namashqiyah. We'll get to this book. But before that, let's be more familiar with the outstanding scholar from your tongue, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Shahid Awwal was born in Jabal al-Amil.
Yes.
We have most of our scholars from the Lebanon, basically. And he was also from Lebanon, the place Jabal al-Amil. And obviously he was known as Sheikh al-Ta'ifa. Some of the scholars have named him as Sheikh al-Ta'ifa or, you know, Imam al-Faqih or Sheikh al-Shahid.
Yes.
Because of the martyrdom that he had. He got martyred. So basically he was one of the famous scholars, one of the famous researchers, the Islamic scholars, and the student of Fakhrul Muhaqqiqin.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously when we talk about Shahid al-Awwal, we know that he was one of the famous scholars, and he was a scholar who had the good knowledge of all the school of thoughts.
Yes.
Of Islam.
Yes.
Where we call them as the Arba'a Madhahib.
Yes.
The four schools. The
schools of thoughts.
Ahl Sunnah.
Ahl Sunnah, that's right.
Because the Shia is different from the Ahl Sunnah. When we talk about the four schools, it's mainly referred to the Sunni school of thought, because Hanafiya, Shafi'iyya, Hanbaliya. So these were known as the four schools. So he was one of the great scholars, and the status that he had, obviously, he had three children who were also the famous personalities. And obviously, because he was one of the great scholars, therefore, we have many other scholars who have talked about him, and they have praised him,
mm-hmm.
especially about his status. Whereas we know that in today's world, and even in the amongst the fuqaha, it was famous that the one who can interpret the book of Shahid al-Awwal, he does not need to learn the jurisprudence.
Yes.
He's a faqih.
Yes.
Himself, the one who can solve this book.
Mm-hmm.
So basically he was someone who brought a revolution, we can say, in the Islamic jurisprudence. And after him, till today, we can see that in the Hawza, in the Islamic seminary,
yes.
everyone studies his book.
His book, that's right. We'll get to his book and his own explanation on the Lummat al-Damashqiyah. But before that, Shaykh Rouhani, give us a picture of the era in which Shahid al-Awwal lived.
up to an extent that he was martyred. Let's talk a little bit about this aspect of his life.
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Of course, Shaheed Awwal, rahmatullahi alayhi, was one of the great scholars of Tashayyu in the history. But unfortunately, of course, as Shia in the history of Islam, the Shia scholars, the Shia people, were oppressed always by the evil rulers, yes. Same as their imams. So, of course, this Shaheed al-Madhloom was also martyred by a group of people in Sham. Actually, first he was imprisoned by them, and then finally he was martyred by them. And unfortunately, as it is mentioned in the history, even his dead body was burned by them.
What was the main reason, Sheikh Rouhani, for his martyrdom?
So you see that because of being the followers of Ahlul Bayt, being Shia, and in those areas they were non-Shia people, the enemies of the Shia were living, that's why they arrested him, and finally, actually, he was martyred by them. This was the story, which is very, really sad, the story of his Shahada, his martyrdom. And of course, I think he was very much influential figure in the history because he had a contact with the Sarbadaran dynasty or the kings of Sarbadaran in Khorasan. They asked him to write a kind of instruction, a jurisprudential instruction for them. So that's why he wrote this Lam'at al-Dimishqiyya for the Salatin and for this Umara of the Shayyu in Khurasan. Yes. But he couldn't go to Khurasan, though he was invited by the last king of Sarbadaran to Khurasan, but he couldn't go there. That's why he wrote this kind of instruction for this group of people in Khurasan. That's why actually he paved the ground for more strengthenness of these kind of Shiite kind of dynasties and hukama or hukuma. So that's why he was also, we can say, a kind of politician or political figure in the history,
that's right.
Because he supported these politicians. While in the in Tashayyu, and also our audience know that there are some scholars who believe that there shouldn't be any kind of hukuma or hakimiyya at the time of Ghaiba. But you see that this Shaheed al-Awwal, rahimahullah, supported this.
Yes.
Actually, Sarbadaran. It seems that, of course, he was not of the idea that at the time of Ghaiba, at the time of occultation, we shouldn't have any kind of hukuma or hakimiyya, while the Sarbadaran had their hukuma in Khorasan.
That's right.
By writing this book, by writing this instruction
and
for
dedication of this book to Sarbadaran.
Yeah, of course. He admitted.
Yes.
He confessed that, this kind of movement in the history of the Shayu is okay, and there's no problem with that, I think.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah.
Al-Lumat al-Damishqiyya, Sayyid Mohsen, was written in the 8th century. We can say Hijra in Arabic language, but still it is today used, we can say, and benefited from in the Islamic seminaries of both Qom, Mashhad, Najaf, Karbala, everywhere, okay? So what is the significance of this book? What is this book exactly?
Well, obviously, this book was, as our dear guest has mentioned, it was written on the request of the Sarbedaran. But it is also said that he wrote this book in 7 days. When it was requested by them, he was imprisoned in Syria. And then there, in 7 days, he wrote this book. Now, the significance of this book is because Shaheed was, he studied in the Syria. He was living in the Syria initially. Yes. And he was amongst the Sunni scholars as well. And the Sunni scholars used to come to his speeches, and he had a good relation with them. He also knew the fiqh or the jurisprudence related to the Ahl Sunnah.
Okay.
Therefore, when he wrote the book, it was a kind of fatwa, like the rulings, direct rulings. And in some portions, he also brought the reasoning why we need to follow this rule. So the both things were there.
by looking at the Sunni sources and the Shia sources. Obviously, because when he's bringing a reason that why we do this, and the reason why the Ahl Sunnah does this and we do not do this, all these reasonings were there. Therefore, his rulings that he brought, we can say these were exact rulings. These were, we can say, obviously the things that he brought. He had a good view on all the aspects of the things, and then how, you know, one ruling was changed from one thing to the other school of thought, how it went. So according to that, when he wrote this, it was a comprehensive book which have 52 chapters, which is more than the chapters which are mentioned in the Wasail al-Shia. Obviously, Wasail al-Shia is the, we can say...
Is this again the Hadithi book, Al-Lu'matullah Mashqiya?
It is Hadithi and Qur'ani both, because okay. when he brings the... proofs or the reasoning, mm-hmm. there sometimes he mentions the, for example, you know, the verses of the Quran. For example, in the chapter of the, you know, we can say trade, there is a famous verse that we have, Ofu bil uqud, you must fulfill your promises. So on top of that, he used to bring the traditions as well. So it is a combination of all. We cannot say it's merely just the traditions.
But fiqh is the yes. most outstanding, we can say, part of this book. Yes.
Yes, obviously. And fiqh is, you know, in the Quran generally what happens is, why we go towards the tradition, there is one more difference. We need to clarify this. Because Quran talks about general rules. Mm-hmm. It does not go to the specifications that how you need to do. For example, Quran says that aqimu salat, you need to establish prayer.
Yes.
Now, how to perform the prayer, it is not in the Quran. Mm-hmm. These are the detail things. Yes. The detailed things are not in the Quran. The major and the general rule is there.
Yes.
Therefore, that's why we mention the, like, bring the verse first, and then for the details, we go towards the tradition.
Okay.
How to do this. That's why the books of the jurisprudence, all of them, they have the most portion is related to the traditions because of these details that we needed, which were given by the prophets and the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam.
That's right. Okay, Shaykh Rouhani, what's your opinion on Al-Lumatul Lamishqiyah? Well, what is this book exactly, Al-Lumatul Lamishqiyah?
I think one of the very important characteristics of this book is this, that Shaheed al-Awwal collected, or actually wrote this book in a way that it is very, what we can say, short, mm-hmm. but at the same time, very much meaningful.
Yes,
and he tried to write, for example, a collection of ahadith or ahkam of Islam in a very short kind of manner. That's important.
Okay,
because the Salatin and Umara, the people who are so much busy, they do not have time to read everything in detail or to refer to in the detailed kind of sources. So that's why, because of this, even for Tullab, it later becomes a very much important book because it was very much short, concise, mm-hmm. and precise.
Okay.
So that's why then later many ulamas started to write explanation commentaries on this book. They are voluminous kind of works by the many ulamas and scholars like Shaheed al-Awwal and the rest of the ulama.
Yes.
On this book. I think one of the very important characteristics of this book is that it is precise and concise. And that is why all of the tulam, ulama, asathid, umara, hukama, and even normal people, all of them made use of this book in the history.
So nowadays, when a talaba, I mean, when an Islamic seminary student wants to read this book, does it need any prerequisite knowledge or preparation before that?
If you refer directly to Al-Lum'a al-Dimashqiyya, yeah? Uh-huh. Of course, you would understand the ahkam of Islam,
okay.
Because he wrote in a way that would be understandable for all the people.
Okay.
But of course, since it is a kind of summarization, or uh-huh. it's a kind of short sort of kind of book, that's why we need to the details as well.
Okay.
But if you study only this kind of short, expression of ahkam or fiqh, of course, you got familiar with the main, actually, parts of fiqh, and you would understand the ahkam.
That's
yeah,
right.
That is. That's why it's useful, and it was welcomed and it was embraced by all the students or different people in the history.
That's all right.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Rouhani and Sayyid Mohsen, for a nice elaboration regarding the life account of Shahid al-Awwal and his magnum opus, Al-Lumatul Lamashqiyah. Some of the most outstanding explanations and commentaries written on this book are Tuhfatul Gharawiyah, Tawzihul Mushkilat, and also the most outstanding one, Al-Rawzatul Bahiyyah fi Sharh Al-Lumatul Lamashqiyah by Shahid al-Sani. We will dedicate one specific program to Shahid al-Sani and his book, Al-Rawzatul Bahiyyah, this outstanding. May Allah bless the soul of the late Muhammad ibn Jamal al-Din Makki al-Amali, mainly known as Shahid al-Awwal, or Sheikh al-Shahid. As also Sheikh Rouhani mentioned, Jamadi al-Awwal 9, 786, Shahid al-Awwal was, we can say, executed in Damascus in a temple, and his body was burnt. This shows extreme animosity of his enemies to this outstanding man and a scholar. And Shahid al-Awwal passed away in this way. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding man, the author of Al-Lumatul Damashqiyah. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information on this outstanding dignitary and other episodes of our program, visit our website at parstoday.ir. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. This is Back to Reality. I am Asma. I have the pleasure to be your host. And here with me, I have two very dear guests, Sister Bita and Brother Muzaffar. Both of you, welcome to Back to Reality.
Assalamu alaikum. My pleasure to be here.
Of course, the pleasure is all in here. Brother Muzaffar, shall we start with you? Please introduce yourself briefly, very much, what you study and...
I'm Muzaffar Haider from the UK. I've studied English literature and now I'm in the Hawza, in the Islamic Seminary.
That's very good. It's a pleasure to have you in here and wish you luck with your studies. You, Sister Bita.
Yes, I'm at your service. I'm Bita, and I study medicine at one of the University of Tehran in Iran.
Undoubtedly, after the coronavirus pandemic, every single one of us has been through too much.
Yeah.
Our lives changed, our point of view, the perspectives that we used to have of life, everything changed. And I don't know if it's in a more tragic way or in a better way. We are more optimist or we are more pessimist. Which one it is, I am not sure. Because if it's about me, then I would say we have turned to be more pessimist. Isn't it?
You.
Oh, I am. Definitely. I'm more pessimistic now.
So you aren't. It didn't have an effect on you.
No, no. I was pessimistic before, and then after the thing, I'm even more pessimistic.
I like it now. And yeah, that's very true.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, I think it was a really harsh time for everyone here.
Yeah.
And, you know, unfortunately, most of the people lost the beloved persons of their families.
Yeah.
I didn't, fortunately, but I feel actually really sorry.
But we heard about other people,
exactly.
You know,
really
our
dark.
Neighbors, many of them.
You know, the death of people. When you went through the, I don't know, street, every house had a black card on themselves. Like, you know, they were mourning for...
That was so sad.
Yeah, it was. But the most difficult actually obstacle in this duration of COVID-19 pandemic for me was being virtual. We had to study in
the virtual life, the yes, virtual life schooling.
It was a pain in the neck. Yeah. It was, you know, we had to, I don't know, study virtually, go to the classes virtually, do everything virtually. And this losing the connection
with the real world,
with the real world was a big pain for me.
Yeah. Mm.
Especially I had the university entrance examination.
That was even worse.
Exactly the 3 years of my life was so dark.
So, brother, you know, it has changed many things in a way that I sometimes have this horror that maybe a new one is going to come. I don't feel like it's finished, you know? I don't feel like it's finished.
Well, I don't like thinking about that, but I have heard that this was just a test, and after this, they're going to release the real bad one.
Oh, my God.
The aim of these groups... The aim of these groups has always been population control and population reduction. If you look at people like Bill Gates, for example,
yeah.
I mean, we actually did a series of videos covering how he talks about this before the pandemic even began. And we said that, look, this person who is absolutely rich mm-hmm. and he owns the pharmaceutical companies and yeah. stuff. He's been talking about reducing the population of humanity.
Well, that's so cruel.
Now, coronavirus did not accomplish that at all. So that's why some people are saying that it's just a test and they wanted to see how well the human beings would react to a global pandemic.
In order to do something, to create something that is even worse.
The next time they're going to do it much, much worse. And that's going to be the one that wipes out. That's just what people say. You know, they might fail. Yeah. If we act appropriately, maybe they'll fail.
I wish, you know, but this is so cruel, I think, reducing the population because we need all of the people here. You know, you are not in a place to judge other people.
Yeah, you know? And to decide when is the time for them to leave.
And I think when you cannot recognize your power and control your power and you think you are the god of this world, this will happen, of course. But let's talk about these changes.
Mm-hmm.
What was the most touchable change you've gone through in these years? Appreciate other people was the most important thing. Because we are apart from our relatives, our friends, and so on, we felt the value of them.
It just crossed my mind. Yes, very true. Yeah. Seize the moment.
Exactly.
Yeah. In past, I used to be thinking about the future too much. But right now, I'm more clinging on right now. Right, like just the present.
Yeah.
You know what happens when you see too much of death around you? You just come to realize that this life is not so worthy think of it to be. And then this is not going to be eternal.
Exactly.
It's going to, and it's more tangible. We would understand that this really is going to happen to me as well. And these dear ones that you have around you, these are not going to be there forever. And since we're getting so tragic, let's just go for a short break.
Let's go.
So, yeah, we're talking about the pandemic and what happened to us after the pandemic and what is going to happen to us in the next pandemics.
Yeah.
And
Hold on. Let me change the atmosphere here, okay? It's gotten a bit too dark.
Yeah.
Let me just say this, all right? I love the pandemic.
How come?
I'm kind of an introvert, okay? I had to stay indoors. Love it. I had to do everything virtually. Love
you know, I'm the same, but yes, when you are forced, it's not good.
No, I don't mind. I get to order everything online. I don't need to go out to the shops and be bothered by. Mm-hmm. I don't need to see anybody. Ugh, it was lovely. Lovely.
It wasn't.
So you can't even go out.
It was so much fun. Yeah, some people died, and that was really sad. And yeah, definitely, if you lose somebody, it's horrible. But you know, they've gone to a better place.
Thank you for your.
Thank you. Now it's no longer dark.
Yeah.
The thing.
I think
there you go.
It is coming darker.
Are your spirits a bit higher now? Yeah,
you've
got to look at the bright side of it. The thing that aggravated me the most and changed me the most was people. The way people reacted to the pandemic, I feel, revealed the stupidity of humanity.
How they reacted to it.
Exactly.
To show, I mean, what did you see in their reaction to feel that they were stupid?
You had, first of all, you had the group who were just panicking. Mm-hmm. They were afraid of everything. Oh my God, oh my God. And those were the people who the virus got.
Everybody was like that at first.
At first everyone was.
I wasn't scared at all.
You're not a monster or something.
Do you feel fear at all?
No, I was scared when I saw other people getting scared.
Oh, so you mean there's no stimulus in this world to make you scared?
No, how do you learn fears, like irrational fears to begin with, right? You see your parents getting scared of a snake and then you get scared of it yourself. That's how you learn to fear things.
No, I see it myself in a field, then I get scared of it. Then I understand that a snake is something scary.
Yeah, I mean, corona was scary-ish. Yeah, I mean, it's like a cold and temperature, a flu.
A bad flu used to get before anyway,
you know.
Yeah.
It wasn't that bad. I'm saying the people who got more scared, they were the ones whose immune systems seemed to not be able to deal with
the
virus.
Of course, yes. Yeah.
So there were the fears. Then there were those people who came along and said, I don't believe in masks. They just don't believe in masks suddenly. They see doctors wearing masks when they're performing surgeries. They would have worn masks before the pandemic if they had even a little cold. But now suddenly they feel like they have to rebel against masks.
I was really cruel.
Then you had the group of people who were literally running around raving lunatic in the streets and spitting on other people and saying that the virus doesn't exist at all.
Oh, yeah.
You remember that?
Yeah,
those guys? Yeah.
This one was so bad.
It's all a conspiracy. The virus doesn't exist at all. Oh,
how could you ignore it when so much of people
are dying?
All
these people are dying.
Then you had the other group. Well, they were saying that all the statistics are being forged and et cetera, and that the pharmaceutical companies and Bill Gates are wanting to kill us. And they were right in one sense, but to deny the virus exists at all is just ridiculous. Then you had the other people who were like, whatever my government tells me, I will do. Full stop. You had like my relatives in the UK and others in Canada and stuff. Oh, you wanna put a vaccine inside me? Go ahead. I'll take the second one. I'll take the third one. I'll take the fourth one. I'll take the fifth one.
Yeah.
Now they're on the fifth one, and these guys are literally they're having strokes and dying not from the virus but
from the vaccination.
From the vaccinations. Yeah. They're not even vaccinations. God knows what it is. And back then, when we were telling them, look, don't trust these vaccines, they were like, oh, you people, you backward Islamic people with your herbal medicine. I'm like, no, I'm not saying it from that perspective. Oh, then you had the herbal medicine guys.
Yeah, exactly.
And you should include Trump in that group, right? Trump is, what was that drug he was saying? He said bleach at one point. And some people in America actually took bleach. They drank bleach and had to go to hospital because of it.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about a handful of people, like hundreds.
Yeah.
Then you had the people who were saying, you know, these herbal stupidity, all of it. See, the stupidity of humanity suddenly came to the surface.
Mm-hmm. And so different reactions.
Selfishness,
yeah.
People had the common sense that, okay, I've got a bit of a cold. I'm not going to come into work today. I don't want to spread my germs everywhere. But when it came to coronavirus, no, we have to be strong. Give me a hug. Like, no, I don't want to give you a hug.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was just complete stupidity. That's what has changed in me. But, you know, أكثرهم لا تعقلون. Most of them just don't contemplate. I actually believe what Allah said now.
But I think pandemic had a special effect on the people who worked in hospitals, especially.
Yeah.
You know, the medical service was, under a very heavy responsibility here in Burden.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were sacrificing themselves.
When I saw all those doctors and all those patients and the hospitals and the situation, everyone was in sort of a turmoil. I just remembered all the novels that I've read, and in all of them there was a plague, and then everybody was so concerned about what's going to happen in the next turn.
Yeah.
And all those things. And then I started to say that the life in this world is always repeating itself.
Yeah, you know, it's cyclical. It's strange like that.
Yeah.
This pandemic reminded me of a book, Blindness. It was like that exactly. We saw the wild nature of the human beings.
Yeah.
You know, they were really selfish. Like, okay, I'm going to survive here. And if you die, okay, that's my problem. You're going to go to a better place. As like a strategy. But, you know, it was really dark for me to see people like that. People were so obsessive with being hygiene, you know. They wanted to be clean. They used alcohol and so on, and everything, even, I don't know, their nutritions. And it was somehow weird for me to see other people so obsessive about using alcohol. And after a time, they were like, okay, so ignorant to that.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
The health organizations were saying that we can't do a lockdown. Why? Not because